Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll look back at how Illinois became a state. While it lacked the required population, those pushing to get Illinois into the Union had a plan, and it worked. The decline of newspapers, especially in rural areas, is a problem, but some high schoolers are working to bring information to the public. We'll explain. We'll also hear about a trip from Chicago to Florida via Amtrak. What's it like to travel a long distance by rail? Some agriculture groups are worried about President-elect Donald Trump's plans for tariffs. We'll also have a report on a Metro East county, long a Democratic stronghold, but Republicans are making inroads. And we'll learn about Peoria's new ordinance that deals with homelessness with punishment that includes fines or even jail time. Those stories and more coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Illinois had another birthday this week. We became a state back in 1818, and now we're the sixth largest state in the country. 6 years ago, Tara McClellan McAndrew wrote about the origin of Illinois statehood for the 200th birthday celebration, and today we revisit the conversation. She tells us there was a time when statehood was far from certain. That changed, though, with a bit of deception. Tara, let's go back 200 years. I doubt most people today can comprehend that there would even be a doubt as to whether Illinois would be ready to be a state, but it was a much different place than what we know today.
It was a much different place. A little bit more than 200 years ago, we were a territory. We weren't a state, of course. And frankly, we were a bit of a backland. We were the Wild West. Illinois really became a state when it did because of one young, ambitious man named Daniel Pope Cook. He went to D.C. to seek a patronage job and was unsuccessful. And when he came back, kind of all of a sudden, he decides we need to be a state. Well, being a state means that there will be more opportunity for everyone, presumably him included. I talked with state historian Sam Wheeler about Daniel Pope Cook's role in all of this.
He buys an interest in the first newspaper printed in the Illinois Territory, and that newspaper becomes his pulpit for advocating for statehood. And I also love this argument that Cook proposes in his newspaper. He says the Illinois Territory is destined for statehood, so why delay the inevitable?
So you focus on Daniel Cook. You also focus on Nathaniel Pope, a relative of his.
Daniel was Nathaniel's nephew. Nathaniel Pope was the Illinois Territory congressional rep who could not vote at that time because we were a territory. And Nathaniel Pope, as one historian told me, basically kind of gets this letter in the mail saying, hey, we decided we want to become a state, and so he just takes it under his wing, makes that his cause, and does some things in the process that work greatly to our advantage as a future state, and they get the job done, and they get it done pretty darn fast.
Well, slavery was still an issue in Illinois. A lot of people don't think of Illinois as a slave state, but back at that time, there were slaves living in Illinois.
Absolutely. And it was legal. And one of the problems in our territory becoming a state was that the law that ruled admission to the Union as a state, the Northwest Ordinance, forbid slavery. So what we had to do was tread a very fine line. We wanted to keep the settlers here, many who came from the South and had brought their slaves and were pro-slavery. We wanted to keep them here. We wanted to get more people here. How do we do that? How do we appease those folks and still toe the line with Northwest Ordinance, which forbids slavery? And we did that by framing our first state's constitution, which basically enabled both. The new state's constitution basically said, we will not allow future slavery, but the existing slaves can stay. It was a bit of wordplay, if you will, that opened the door for what became slavery in Illinois by another name, indentured servitude.
So Illinois becomes a state in 1818. About 40 years later, Abraham Lincoln is elected president, and you wrote that the way that the state's northern boundary was configured really helped ensure that Lincoln did win the presidency. Otherwise, he may never have risen to that level.
That is according to one man I interviewed, Frank Cicero Jr., who just wrote a book about this. And he looked at the vote totals that the Republican Party garnered up in the northern part of Illinois. Our boundaries were extended by our territorial congressional rep, Nathaniel Pope, before we became a state. When he applied to Congress and said, hey, we want to be a state, he also said the boundary should include the bottom half of Lake Michigan, so we would have access to what became Chicago. It wasn't at the time, of course. This opened up, as we now know, an enormous land for a lot of population, future population. And Frank Cicero Jr. has looked at the votes and the research and has said, if that boundary had not been extended by Nathaniel Pope, we may never have had Abraham Lincoln as our president.
Circling back to the decision to seek statehood in 1818, is it safe to say that the state then jumped the gun on this?
I think it is. Yeah, I do. First of all, there was no real call from the residents for us to gain statehood. And we didn't have the population. It's very clear. It's a pretty funny story, really, about how we frankly lied. We cooked the books. We were supposed to have 60,000 people. We didn't have near that. But we had to prove to Congress that we had 40,000. Frankly, we didn't have that. So one of the historians I interviewed was Illinois State Archives Director Dave Jones. He explains very well about how we handled that problem.
Nathaniel Pope, what he did, which was brilliant, was when you conduct a census, it's the federal government that conducts a census. He slipped into the bill that, hey, don't worry about it. Illinois will do the census for you. You guys are busy there in Washington. You don't want to take the time. We'll conduct the census. And the federal government bought it.
In many ways, we weren't ready, but we made it work, right? The Illinois way, we made it work.
Is it safe to say, had they waited too long, we might be a much smaller state today and a less powerful state?
You could probably make that argument. It's hard to say how long we would have had to wait to be less powerful, but certainly by starting this process as early as we did, we were in a position to grab land that ended up helping us enormously. In retrospect, while it was premature, it served us very, very well.
Tara McClellan McAndrew, she wrote about Illinois and how it became a state in 1818. We just celebrated Illinois' 206th birthday this week. Peoria is the largest of a growing number of Illinois towns banning homeless encampments after a U.S. Supreme Court decision in June. Unhoused folks in Peoria are facing stiff fines, even possible jail time, if they remain in the campsites after the city's new ban goes into effect. Joe Deacon reports.
Anxious, uncertain, fearful. These are just a few of the emotions Peoria's unsheltered residents and advocacy groups are feeling in the aftermath of the city's recently approved public encampment ban. Seth Phillips has been living on the streets of Peoria for just over a year. He calls the ordinance, with fines and possible jail time as penalties, ridiculous.
I suffered a head injury, lost my job, my house, and pretty much everything that I had. And I've been on the street bouncing around from place to place since then. I usually camp whenever shelter is available. I do use the shelters, but right now I'm currently staying in a tent.
Phillip says many of the people living in the camps are in circumstances much like his, something the people backing the ordinance don't understand.
It's not something that they decided for themselves. They didn't decide one day that I'm going to go be homeless and then deal with this and that, you know. I don't think I've ever met a person who said that in my life. Yeah, I want to be homeless, not have a job, not have an income, not have a place to lay my head at night. So I'm constantly sleeping on benches, bridges, rocks, grass, wet spot, wherever. There's no fun in it at all.
Peoria became the largest city in Illinois with a public camping ban 2 weeks ago when the city council passed the ordinance on a 6-5 vote. City staff said it would be 30 days before they could begin clearing campsites. Mayor Rita Ali is not signing the measure, although that action is a symbolic gesture since she doesn't have veto power. Chris Schaffner, the executive director of the nonprofit Jolt Foundation, says the ban is short-sighted.
If they're going to pass an ordinance that is going to close these encampments and ban public camping on city property, then they have to have a robust system to get these people connected to, and we just don't have that. When you look at the number of shelter beds and available housing units and the need, there's a massive disparity there. We are well short of that mark, and we're not going to fix that in 30 days. So to enact such a punitive, criminalizing of these folks without having an alternative is draconian.
Schaffner says community nonprofits started meeting about what they can do next to help those affected immediately after the ban's passage. Kate Green is the executive director of the Home for All Continuum of Care.
When these ordinances are enacted, and we've seen this in other communities, is that it displaces the problem, and it can go to unintended places like doorsteps and stoops and in places where weren't intended in the first place either. So I think there's going to be real friction in terms of the enforcement of this ordinance and for people who are just trying to survive.
Green says there's around 600 people in their multi-county system who are seeking permanent housing assistance. Peoria City officials estimate there's around 40 to 50 people staying at downtown campsites along Interstate 74. But that figure could be low. Casey Bernard, the co-founder of Lula Peoria and outreach director for Jolt, says it's as high as 90. She says the people she works with are in despair.
No matter how many times you throw away someone's tent, fine them, or jail them, it doesn't give them a home. It doesn't make them not homeless. These are humans. These are Peoria's most vulnerable citizens.
Community Development Director Joe Doolin says the city is working with the community groups to get as many campsite residents as possible housed before enforcement starts. City Attorney Patrick Hayes says the ordinance is modeled after the state's trespassing law that Peoria already applies in many cases. Hayes says in his time with the city, it's never reached a point where someone is jailed. Peoria County Sheriff Chris Watkins says it's too soon to know what kind of impact this may have on the jail. With the ban going into effect just before the start of winter, Seth Phillips fears the consequences could be dire.
Not everybody's going to make it, I don't think. They're either going to end up in jail or they're going to end up taking their own lives because they've already got the world on their shoulders, and it's hard. It's hard. And just to have the mental strength to keep going, like tomorrow's another day, not everybody's going to make it, man.
Amid the uncertainty created by the ban, Chris Schaffner says Jolt and the other nonprofits will keep doing all they can to help Peoria's unsheltered residents. I'm Joe Deacon.
Well, the decline in local newspapers across the country has hit Illinois especially hard. Michael Puente brings us details.
Over the last two decades, 86% of journalists have lost their jobs in Illinois, the highest percentage in the nation. That's according to the Medill State of Local News report, and Illinois ranks sixth in the nation in the number of newspapers closing down over the past year. Tim Franklin is director of the Medill Local News Initiative at Northwestern University.
There's now research that shows that in news desert or low information counties, that civic participation declines. The turnout in local elections goes down.
Earlier this year, Illinois lawmakers passed legislation mandating $25 million in tax credits to local news organizations over 5 years.
Michael Puente with that report. Meanwhile, some Central Illinois student journalists are getting bylines in their local papers. With that scoop, here's Colin Shope.
The Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University says more than half of U.S. counties have no or limited access to local news. 228 more counties are at risk of becoming news deserts.
We need journalism. We need to be credibly informed, and we need to be engaged in what's going on. And journalism is a way to do that.
That's Clinton Soper, an English language arts teacher at Roanoke Benson High School in Roanoke, 40 minutes northeast of Peoria. Soper's students supply articles to the local paper, the Woodford County Journal.
Something about having the traditional newspaper and seeing the writing and seeing the students' names and the bylines there, it's really meaningful to them. And I always tell my students to be proud if they see their writing published.
Two students in Soper's dual credit English composition class were recently published in the journal covering community issues. Senior August Matthews wrote a report on the need for volunteer emergency personnel, a local perspective on a national issue. Her work included interviewing, research, and analysis.
When I was interviewing the ambulance chief, she gave me some information on like when the ambulance was first founded so that I could get some background information to compare it to today's numbers.
Senior Mary Gett covered a praise night and fundraising event at her family's church. The congregation recently learned their church could close.
Obviously, I'm not a impartial opinion. Like, my opinion is very deep in this topic because it's my church is being closed, and it was tough to say, like, well, how mean do I want to be? How real do I want to be in this article? And yeah, it was hard to balance that.
Both students have a personal connection to their topic, but they're also practicing concepts like writing in a journalistic voice and managing their own biases. Clinton Soper says it's important for students to have opportunities to cover issues that have an impact beyond the walls of their high school.
Because they are, as cliche as it sounds, you know, they are the future. They're the ones who are going to inherit these communities of ours. They're the ones who are going to be in the positions of responsibility. And it's important for them to be able to use their voices as active, involved members of the community.
Some area institutions are helping students sculpt reporting skills even earlier. Holly Rocky is a humanities teacher at Peoria Academy. Every Wednesday after school, she and 15 middle school age students dissect a copy of the Journal Star together.
Then teaching them how to conduct interviews, how to make sure they're citing sources, how to look at a question of something that's going on, and then look at it a little bit deeper. So it's not just listing the facts, it's also then starting to find the story underneath those facts.
After learning the basics, Rocky says students move on to the next step, getting published. Since last year, Peoria Academy students have published opinion pieces in the monthly Community Word newspaper. Students have opined on topics like crime and legislation. Their most recent piece, published November 6th, argued for the merits of bipartisanship. Rocky says she does minimal editing, even as students handle these broad topics.
I'll give them feedback, but really it is the ownership of the students that have to go through and figure out what's the story they want to tell, how do they want to tell it, and it's really fun to watch them work together to put together something that's high quality.
And it's getting harder to find quality news in some places. Roanoke senior August Matthews says social media can be a resource. Classmate Mary Gett says her family doesn't get a newspaper anymore.
We're moving away from newspapers, which is unfortunate because there is a certain kind of journalism that can only be given to the public through newspapers, but yeah, a lot of information is spread through word of mouth.
Gett and Matthews both say they enjoyed the challenge of writing a journalistic report. Though the future of news is evolving, maybe they or other students like them will be a resource for their communities and found the journalism of the future. I'm Colin Shope.
We'll be back right after this. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. It can be hard to say goodbye, especially if you may never speak to that person again. That's the case for students and teachers who were at the Stateville Correctional Center near Chicago. The prison closed this fall, and because of Illinois Department of Corrections policy, some of those pursuing higher ed degrees were transferred away from their teachers with no contact allowed. Emily Hayes has more.
Each time DePaul University professor Christina Rivers entered the classroom to teach, more of her students were gone.
And because I can't interact with them when I'm not there, I can't reach out and say, hey, who's leaving? You know, let me say goodbye, or I can't email them goodbye.
Rivers couldn't bring herself to say goodbye in person either. In her second to last class, her icebreaker question was about what the class meant to everyone.
Kleenex was needed.
Since 2016, Rivers has taught at Stateville Correctional Center, which had some of the worst conditions of any Illinois prison. This spring, Governor J.B. Pritzker announced the facility would be torn down and rebuilt. Transfers of the men incarcerated there started in August.
Even if they were on the list for that day, if they were transferred out at 8 o'clock, we get there at 10:30, they're gone.
The Illinois Department of Corrections says most of the 109 students enrolled in Stateville's higher education programs were transferred to a facility that supported what they were doing. But Rivers noticed about a dozen of DePaul students were not transferred to its future site, Hill Correctional Center in Galesburg.
Some were real stalwarts, constant participants, real consistent participants, did substantive work, and it's still kind of sinking in. I'll never get to see them again. I'll probably never get to work with them again unless they get out.
Starting in 2012, DePaul University led an inside-out prison exchange program in Stateville. The goal was to bring incarcerated and free students together to learn as equals. But they don't have equal relationships with their professors. Illinois Department of Corrections policy does not allow volunteers to, quote, socialize or fraternize with any individual in custody. They can't communicate by phone, electronic mail, or letter, or disclose their phone number or email. In an email, IDOC said the policy is designed to ensure the safety of volunteers, individuals in custody, facility staff, and the public.
To me, like, logically, it should be abolished.
That's Joseph Dole.
It's all based off a myth, you know. They're just, like, assuming you're in prison, So you're always trying to, you know, do something criminal with every conversation.
He was transferred from Stateville to Pinckneyville Correctional Center in Southern Illinois. He says the policy makes it hard to maintain the positive communities created in the classroom.
So it's like they're constantly trying to dehumanize us and keep us away from, you know, like people we've spent decades with. There's people we've been in classrooms with for 5, 10 years.
Joel says the no contact policy should be abolished because mentorship and community helps people to successfully re-enter society when they are released.
If I get out tomorrow, who do you think's going to help me get on my feet and be a part of the community and help solve social issues?
In 2000, Dole was convicted of murder based on an Illinois law that holds people accountable for the actions of others. He has maintained he is innocent. While serving his life sentence, Dole has completed a bachelor's degree, co-founded a nonprofit, published 3 books, and authored bills for the Illinois legislature.
A lot of us are making up for shit lies we're leading out there. You know, we're on the streets and, you know, doing whatever stupid things as kids. And now we're more community-minded. We're more, you know, focused on the health of the community, society.
He says that's been hard to do after his transfer.
As soon as we transfer, we can't be involved in those causes because we can't maintain contact with the people that were giving us access to do that.
And the no-contact policy affects professors, too. At Stateville, Dole was in DePaul's public policy think tank with Christina Rivers. Other professors we spoke with said they were worried about even mentioning any student names on the record for fear they wouldn't be allowed back into prisons to teach.
They're so scared of the IDOC just banning them for no reason. You know, it's like they always have that power over them.
The Illinois Department of Corrections also declined to comment whether there's any appetite to change their no-contact rule. It's possible that Joseph Dole will be able to reunite with Christina Rivers and the other professors and volunteers he's worked with if he can be transferred to Hill Correctional Center. If that happens, he plans to become a teaching assistant again.
When I was TAing classes in Stateville, I'm making $1,500 a class. You know, I'm using that money to hire a lawyer now, and I use that money to buy Christmas gifts for my daughters and my grandson.
Rivers says that while it's hard to realize she may never work with longtime students again, she's looking ahead.
We'll be taking in all kinds of new people, and I'm totally looking forward to that.
Dole is allowed to petition for his transfer to Hill on December 10th. I'm Emily Hayes.
Remember Michael Jackson's Smooth Criminal? How about Beyoncé's Single Ladies? The moves in those iconic music videos were inspired by choreographer Bob Fosse and his wife, dancer Gwen Verdon. But to perform Fosse, you need permission from the Fosse-Verdon estate. So it's a big deal that Chicago's Hubbard Street Dance has been chosen as the first company to add one of its works to its repertoire. Here's NPR's Elizabeth Blair.
Humor, attitude, and precision. That's classic Fosse Verdon. On the Ed Sullivan Show in the 1960s, Gwen Verdon and two other dancers wore bright yellow and pink pantsuits for a joyful, jazzy piece. Even the tiniest gestures are timed perfectly to the music. Quick pelvic thrusts, bobbing heads, flicks of the wrist. Fosse and Verdon were partners in life and dance. Their daughter, Nicole Fosse, says they would spend hours creating together.
As my mother used to say, we were just funky junking around in a studio together, just playing around. The language in the household, the language between my parents was dance, was humor, was storytelling through movement.
Bob Fosse grew up in Chicago. It's also where he and a friend started dancing professionally at age 12 as the Riff Brothers. Nicole has been working to preserve her parents' legacy. She was a co-executive producer on the FX series Fosse Verdon, starring Sam Rockwell and Michelle Williams. Nicole knew that Lou Conti, the founder of Hubbard Street Dance, worked with her parents on Broadway and that her mother had worked with the company.
She and Lou had a really lovely, amicable relationship.
In 2019, she asked former Fosse dancer Linda Haberman if she would reimagine some of the short pieces her parents created for TV.
I first had to go and reconstruct the numbers from the old video of the TV shows and then figure out a way to connect it with some new choreography, but all based on Bob Fosse steps. I worked with him a lot, so I know kind of how he worked.
Like turning everyday movements into dance, as Gwen Verdon did when she and other dancers put out their cigarettes in a 1960s TV special.
They drop the cigarette and they put their foot on it and start smashing it out. A normal person would twist your foot to put the cigarette out, but then they're twisting their foot and they're like, oh, that felt good. Now my hip's moving. Oh, now my whole booty's moving. And all of a sudden, they're just having so much fun, and it all stemmed from just putting out a cigarette.
Turning small gestures into sensuality and stories is a hallmark of Fosse Verdon's work. Nicole Fosse says she sees her parents' impact everywhere.
Bob Fosse's influence is huge in today's culture, sometimes very obviously so, and sometimes much more subtly so.
Now with Hubbard Street Dance, Nicole Fosse says it's more than preservation. It's moving her parents' work forward. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
If you want to get away, you might be jealous of Ellery Jones, the Chicago Sun-Times reporter. She took a direct Amtrak train from Chicago to Miami to see what it's like to travel that way, and she talked with Mary Dixon about it.
So I'm just curious, 2 days on a train, were you into train travel before this?
I wasn't to train travel. A few years ago, I took a train from Chicago to California, which is a beautiful route. And so when my boss was like, does somebody want to ride the first iteration of the Floridian? Of course, my hand shot up.
Tell us what it's like. What are the vibes on a train that's going, you know, that long of a distance, taking that long to get from Chicago to Florida?
I think it's a really unique experience because it's not like the plane, you know. Everybody who is on Amtrak for that long, they're opting into it because they're into the train, they're into the experience. They have elected to take a 48-hour trip and they know that they're probably not going to get there on time. We got into Miami about 2 hours delayed. It's a beautiful way to see the country. There's this really funny kind of community that forms on the train. You get to know the crew. You get to know all your other passengers. There's lots of opportunities to talk to people and meet new people, whether you want to or not. It's a really unique experience.
One of my number one concerns is, what is the bathroom situation like?
So if you splurge on a sleeper car, you get shower or bathroom shared in your car or one in your bedroom. However, the Sun-Times did not have the budget for a sleeper car. Okay. Please consider buying a Sun-Times membership. So that we can afford a sleeper car next time. Instead, we are in coach all the way, which is a little bit like flying in an airplane for 2 days, except with a little bit more legroom. So the bathroom situation was pretty rough.
Do you think folks who maybe not are geared toward train travel, is this the kind of journey that they might consider taking?
Maybe start with something shorter or splurge on a sleeper car where you have access to a proper restaurant instead of coach where you only have access to a little snack bar where all the food is microwaved. The dining car is beautiful. We got taken on a tour by an Amtrak employee who showed us the kitchen and like all the beautiful food that they have. And we didn't get to eat any of it. If you're a new Amtrak rider, I would maybe consider doing that. But we recently published a story with some shorter Amtrak routes that are just one state over or short day trips that might be better suited for the first time rider.
And I think you kind of referred to this before, but there are things that do make it worth it, right?
The views are gorgeous. I mean, even this route is not the most scenic route. I highly, highly recommend the Zephyr. The views through Colorado are gorgeous. The views through Pennsylvania that we saw were beautiful, like waking up in Georgia, going through the swamp and like seeing the sunrise was just, it was so beautiful. And I really, the highlight is the people. it's a really great way to just really slow down and think about what you're doing with your life and meet some really cool people. We met a lot of really cool people. We met a couple who had just gotten married, actually a few blocks from me. I found out that their rehearsal dinner was just down the street from me, and we got to talk about all our connections. It was just a really sweet, beautiful time.
Well, Ellery Jones is an audience engagement specialist and journalist for the Chicago Sun-Times. Thank you, Ellery. Have a safe trip home.
Thank you.
Insects play a crucial role in ecosystems all around the world, and scientists say we still have much more to discover. That includes how the tiny creatures talk to each other. More scientists are exploring insect vibrations as communication. And as Harvest Public Media's Hector Alejandro Arzate reports, one Midwest professor's research has been foundational to that study.
When you think of bug sounds, you probably hear buzzing and chirping. But there are thousands of insects that humans can't hear. Rex Cocroft has made a career out of capturing their performances, and I got to hear them play live.
You're lucky because usually there's an observer effect, and if I try to show somebody what they're doing, they'll be completely quiet.
That melody is coming from a species called treehoppers. Well, sort of. Those are actually vibrations, which Cocroft says are so tiny that you could touch a leaf with your finger and not feel anything. But by borrowing from his fellow musicians, he is a pianist after all, Cocroft can capture what they're saying using music equipment. He clips a tiny microphone onto a plant stem. The treehopper's little vibrations are then amplified through a small speaker.
That's it. You can see it's very simple. And now we're listening to these insects talking to each other.
Cocroft is a researcher at the University of Missouri in Columbia, and for the past 30 years, his work has helped scientists better understand how these insects communicate. And with more than 3,000 species of treehoppers across 6 continents, there's a lot being said.
Most of the sounds out there have never been heard by humans, and you can literally go into a backyard in Missouri and hear a sound that no one has ever heard before. And it might be something rather strange and interesting that no one has ever heard before.
It's called insect vibrational communication. In treehoppers, they vibrate different parts of their bodies, which are transmitted onto plant stems. Those are shared with other treehoppers, who tell one another where to find the best food and to warn about predators. Cocroft has been a pioneer in this research. Now, other scientists are finding practical applications, like at Oregon State University, where researchers are using robots to mimic insect sounds to protect vineyards from pests. At St. Louis University, Casey Fowler-Finn and her colleagues are trying to understand how climate change could impact insect populations.
And we look at how it affects the rates of mating, how it affects how they sound, and whether they can still detect each other, even though temperature makes animals sound different.
Fowler-Finn, who considers Cocroft a mentor, says they're using the chirping rates of crickets as a sort of thermometer because vibrations are faster at hotter temperatures. Rafa Rodriguez also studied with Cocroft. The University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee professor says his research was inspired in part by the first time he heard treehoppers.
That just blew my mind. It was like the first time you go snorkeling underwater and then this whole new universe, this whole new dimensions of color and corals kind of open up. It was like that, but in sound.
Now he studies insect communication and the memories and predatory behavior of spiders. Cocroft's work has also inspired researchers far beyond the Midwest. That includes Sam England, a postdoctoral scientist at the Natural History Museum in Berlin, Germany. He's actually in Australia right now doing fieldwork.
If you hear any animal sounds in the background, that is why.
Like others, Inkland says he's learned a lot from Cocroft, from his research contributions to even sharing specimens. So when Inkland and his team discovered a new species of treehopper in Costa Rica, they named it Cladonota rex in his honor.
He's really fleshed out this field in a way that certainly deserved acknowledgement.
Cocroft points out, so far researchers have found just the one single Cladonota rex.
So I don't know if there's any chance for me to go out and see one, but it's a beautiful insect, and it was an honor to have it named after me.
Ultimately, he hopes more people will take interest in insects and figuring out just how and what they're communicating. I'm Hector Alejandro Arzate.
Ahead, we'll talk about trade and concerns in the agriculture sector. That's on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. An Illinois task force focused on warehouse safety voted this week to make a recommendation that those buildings should have storm shelters. The 16-member group of state lawmakers, a mayor, and representatives from industry and trade groups formed last year following a 2021 tornado that killed six people in an Amazon warehouse in Edwardsville. The group will write a final report on its recommendations by the end of this month and then submit them to the Illinois General Assembly for consideration. Democrats used to win St. Clair County in the Metro East by double-digit margins, but in the last few elections, that margin has gotten closer, leaving some to wonder if Republicans can flip the county, like most others in downstate Illinois. Will Bauer reports.
In 2008, Democrats in St. Clair County won contested races on average by more than 20 percentage points. In last month's election, that margin stood at 7 points. It's figures like that that make St. Clair County Republican Party Chairman Michael Butler hopeful.
Things have changed a lot, and I think, you know, we're just kind of a little bit behind the trend, you know, compared to our neighbors, but I think eventually we'll be in a similar boat.
What it will take to make that happen will largely come down to the battle over one voting group, the working class.
Really what's happening is the wealthy suburbs, the wealthy areas are trending Democrat, the working class areas are trending Republican, and that's going to continue.
That's Republican State Representative Kevin Schmidt of Millstadt, who's now won a state house seat that covers most of southern St. Clair County in back-to-back elections. Previously, he'd been represented by Democrats for generations. He feels his record of fiscal conservatism helped him win, supporting legislation to reduce taxes and advocating for a lower cost of living. Schmidt is one of six Republicans that voters in parts of St. Clair County now send to Springfield. Now, it's important to note, Republicans did not win any countywide offices on November 5th. Democrats also hold a 19-9 advantage on the St. Clair County Board. Longtime Democratic State Representative Jay Hoffman of Swansea sees the long-term trend another way. Barack Obama carried the party in 2008 and 2012 to big victories.
He was an Illinois senator. He was from Illinois, and I believe that you know, skewed the numbers in favor of the Democrats in those presidential years.
That's not to say Hoffman isn't concerned. In his eyes, his party, especially locally, remains the party of the working class, championing issues like raising the minimum wage and creating good-paying jobs.
I believe, unfortunately, nationally, we did not carry that message.
Getting back to the issues of working-class families is a view that fellow Democrat Tom Holbrook, a former state representative and now county clerk, shares.
Anytime that the Democratic Party doesn't represent working families to the fullest, I'm concerned.
Regardless of party, something nearly every politico and elected official has noticed in local races is the nationalization of politics. In very few instances are races decided on local issues anymore. Bill Enyart, a former Democratic congressman from Belleville, believes that's the case. For example, Enyart says Trump has been an effective messenger, peeling away the working class vote from Democrats.
Unfortunately, the National Democratic Party has not found a way to combat that or to counteract that. And that bleeds down into the local races.
Now, Enyart and Hoffman believe St. Clair County has largely beat the national trends because of solid local party leadership. And they say Democrats will be able to stop margins from getting any closer. The opposite happened just north in Madison County 10 years ago. It also used to be a Democratic stronghold. Republicans now hold a 20-6 supermajority on that county board. No Democrat even ran for a countywide office this cycle. Former Republican Congressman John Shimkus of Collinsville started his political career in the 1990s. Shimkus says labor support helped him win. He noticed back then that Madison County and other southern Illinois union workers weren't always Democratic voters.
Well, they're pretty conservative, you know. They're less government, lower taxes, have more personal freedoms and liberties. They go to church, they hunt.
Furthering support among that voting group is a theme that Butler with the county GOP wants to build on. He says Trump deserves the credit for opening the door to the working class, but that leaves the local party with a challenge.
They're Trump supporters. They're not necessarily Republicans, but I think that there's an opportunity to, like, help them make that transition. And that's something that we've got to do if we want to continue to have success in the future.
Whether Republicans can further that transition is a question that likely won't get answered for another 2 years. In St. Clair County, I'm Will Bauer.
President-elect Donald Trump promised increased tariffs on the campaign trail, and since the election, he's doubled down on that pledge, targeting Canada, Mexico, and again, China. Charlie Schlinker reports Illinois' agriculture organizations still hope he doesn't mean it.
President Trump's first term was pretty good for farmers on tax policy, not so much for trade. Tariffs imposed on China prompted a backlash, which cost farmers like Ryan Frieders of Waterman, Illinois, global market share.
It was pretty detrimental to the soybean market as a U.S. farmer.
Ryan Whitehouse is the director of national legislation for the Illinois Farm Bureau. Whitehouse says they understand there are players and practices in the global market that need to be addressed, but corn, beef, and pork also take hits.
Slapping just tariffs, it is a little scary to a farmer, and we hesitate a little bit here at Illinois Farm Bureau when we hear, well, we'll just tariff other countries, because we know who's going to take that first, and it's going to be the Illinois farmer, the American farmer, through retaliatory tariffs. And we don't need anything else to hurt the farm economy. The farm economy is struggling right now.
Agriculture groups hope the promised trade restrictions will be brief. Rodney Weinzerl farms near Stanford in McLean County. He's also the executive director of the Illinois Corn Growers Association. Weinzerl says a second Trump administration could use the tariffs as a lever to level out unfair trade practices other countries exert on the U.S.
And it's used as kind of a bargaining step to get them at the table to get something worked out, rather than kind of a therapeutic tariff, you know, that goes on for a really long time with kind of no bargaining of trying to resolve it.
Ryan Frieders seconds Weinzerl's idea. Frieders sits on the Government Relations Committee for the Illinois Soybean Association.
I think President-elect Trump is a very smart businessman. And I think that he is not afraid to use tariffs if he needs to, as we've seen in the past. But hopefully it could be a tactic to just bring people back to the table.
And some of the trade practices the U.S. criticized as unfair go beyond tech and consumer goods. The Illinois Farm Bureau's Ryan Whitehouse says there are ag-specific barriers the Trump administration could take on.
When we import products from other countries like a Brazil, when we import ethanol at zero tariff from them, but they slap an 18% tariff on our ethanol, you know, that's an unfair practice.
Recent history suggests the effect of tariffs could be long-lasting, regardless of how brief they are. Ryan Frieders of the Soybean Association acknowledges China has continued to buy some soybeans, but has largely transferred its buying to South American countries.
It has not come back. We have not regained our market share with that market.
Part of the reason is U.S. trade restrictions on China have continued, and vice versa. Rodney Weinzerl of the Corn Growers Association says another piece is that nations want to make sure their food supply is coming from a secure source. So when the U.S. hit China, China invested in countries like Brazil to build infrastructure for more row crop production.
And so that would be, in particular, an area that could have potentially a long negative effect.
Weinzerl says it's hard to predict whether the row crop market share loss will be permanent.
You continue to see expansion of especially meat consumption in developing countries throughout Southeast Asia. You know, you will see continued meat exports or grain exports for those countries to raise livestock.
If not China, ag groups hope the incoming administration will look to open new markets and create free trade agreements elsewhere with more partners around the world. Ryan Frieder says it's crucial for this state. 60% of soybeans in the U.S. are exported, and because of the river transportation network, it's even higher in Illinois.
We've been focusing a lot of our efforts on Egypt and North Africa. That would be a great market for us to be able to expand into. And then Asia, continuing not only to include China, but other countries in Asia where their protein sources are changing and they're needing some of our soybeans to maybe feed some of their aquaculture or poultry.
Frieders notes the House version of the tentative Farm Bill reauthorization does double dollars for market access and trade promotion. In the first Trump administration, the government did make efforts to mitigate the impact of trade barriers on farmers. The U.S. Department of Agriculture issued market facilitation payments, or MFPs. They didn't make farmers whole, but the Farm Bureau's Ryan Whitehouse says they were absolutely necessary.
There have been no talks about market MFP 2 yet. We in the ag sector are kind of sitting on the edge of our chair waiting to see how much of the talk was political rhetoric and campaign rhetoric, and how much is going to be implemented.
At this point, White House says ag groups hesitate to ask for direct payments, and they're doing everything they can to encourage the incoming administration to open up markets and, if imposed, make tariffs thoughtful and targeted, not willy-nilly.
Because it hurts, you know, American agriculture and the farmer and the rural way of life, because a lot of small towns, if the American farmer is hurting, the smaller towns struggle too.
Despite President Trump's history of protectionism and current low commodities prices, farmers say they're optimistic over the long haul because the world needs to eat. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Richard Hunt was a prolific black sculptor from Chicago's South Side. He died last year. He used his art to express grief, racial trauma, and liberation. His abstract metal creations are on display at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Museum in Springfield. Mawa Iqbal spent a day at the exhibit with Hunt's biographer and close friend John Ott. And the music you'll hear is composed by Randy Irwin. It's inspired by what Hunt would listen to while sculpting.
At the opening of the exhibition is a somber, reflective moment to see one of Hunt's first welded sculptures. Hero's Head is a depiction in sculptural form of the lynched body of Emmett Till that Richard saw in the funeral in 1955 that he attended with his family. This was attended by thousands and thousands of people on the South Side of Chicago. Emmett Till became a spark of the civil rights movement, and very important also within the context of Richard's finding himself, his own aim and direction is his artistic practice. The sculpture is a little smaller than life size. It was of a 14-year-old Emmett, but the sculpture recounts in somewhat abstracted form the horrible tragedy that this lynching had on Emmett Till's head. A crushed face, a missing eyeball, a cracked skull. One of the largest sculptures in the exhibition is From the Sea, which was commissioned by McDonald's Corporation from Hunt in 1983. That was the year that Ronald Reagan finally passed a federal holiday for Martin Luther King Jr. This particular sculpture, of nearly 6 foot tall and just as wide, represents crashing waves of the Red Sea. And you can see through the overarching waves that look quite menacing as they're crashing down, the path and the opening of the Red Sea created by Moses to help the Israelites escape. This particular moment was captured in a speech by Martin Luther King Jr. in his 1956 sermon, which was titled The Death of Evil Upon the Seashore. And in that particular speech, King said, and I quote here, "There is a Red Sea in history that ultimately comes to carry the forces of goodness to victory. And that same Red Sea closes in to bring doom and destruction to the forces of evil." As we leave the exhibition, one of the more poignant pieces is the maquette for Hero Ascending, recalling back to Hunt's origin story, really the origin of his artistic life and practice, having seen Emmett, and then now at the end of his life, having been commissioned to build a sculptural monument to Emmett himself. And you can see the forms of wings, you can see the uplift throughout the sculpture, where he ultimately aimed his life's work was this idea of freedom and growth. And this was his reaction after processing the trauma of Emmett Till, that he would spend the rest of his life dedicating his sculptural practice to the highest achievements of Black Americans, as well as people all across the world, which is the desire for freedom.
John Ott, a biographer and longtime friend of the Chicago sculptor Richard Hunt. We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for being with us. Join us again next time. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. You can find our shows where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois public radio stations.